Richard Cobb is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison workers are preparing to execute Cobb by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, where more than a third of all U.S. executions are carried out. Cobb's execution will be the 496th in Texas in the modern era, a record no other state comes close to matching. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, special guest Susan Orlansky, an attorney whose firm in Anchorage, Alaska, has an impressive record of pro bono work, including a prisoner on Texas death row. The execution watch for Richard Cobb begins.
And this program is being broadcast live on Thursday, the 25th of April, 2013. If you're listening and expecting the Living Art Show, it has been preempted because of the grave matter of Texas executions. However, we have Michael Woodson on another microphone. I can't see him, but I could hear him if he started talking. Michael?
Good evening, Ray.
Good evening. I'm sorry to have disappointed your audience that your usually fine show is not broadcast, and I appreciate the generosity of you and your program staff for allowing us to do Execution Watch instead.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for all your work.
And what do you have coming up next week on Living Art?
Next week we will be interviewing the Joanna House, and then Project Row Houses will be on.
Do you like this new time zone that you're in at 6 o'clock in the evening as opposed to at the wee hours of
the
morning?
Well, I know the artists like it a lot. Me, I'm an insomniac. The 6 a.m. is okay, but yeah, it's much, much better for the community.
Michael, I want to thank you for your generosity to us, and I want to thank you for your longtime generosity of bringing your art and talent to radio station KPFT Houston.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so we have got a report from Huntsville. Is that true? Can you put... Hello, Gloria? Gloria. We don't have Gloria. We're working on Gloria. Well, okay, we don't know what that is. And so with Gloria to tell us what's going on in Huntsville, I will go immediately to Jim Skelton. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, back in 2002, there were two men that went on a robbery spree. And what happened is, in fact, you mentioned to me, Ray, Aaron Cobb had met the co-defendant, a gentleman named Adams, when they were in boot camp as juveniles, I understand.
Young juveniles.
Anyway, by this time, they met, they were 9 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And they graduated up to about 18, were doing a series of robberies in Rusk. And those not familiar with Texas, Rusk is in deep East Texas. And what happened, they had done two robberies in August of 2002, and then on around the 2nd of September, they went to I believe Jack told me it's a Shamrock Service Station store around 10:30 at night. It's a convenience store. And they had been doing robberies with shotguns, and when you go in, they would use ski masks and gloves to make sure they weren't identified. Mm-hmm. Well, in this particular case, it went in, and there were three people present during the robbery. There was a clerk named Nikki Ansley, a clerk named Candace Driver, and a man named Kenneth Vandiver. And Vandiver was had a sad case because he had been injured in a car wreck when he was in college and had the mind of a child. And what he did, he'd hang around the station and help them take out trash and do sweeping like that. They held a shotgun on both girls, put them behind the cash register, jerked the money out, and then, somewhat seems like an afterthought, they then decided to abduct all three people. They abducted the two female clerks, along with the customer inside the store, the retarded gentleman. And they stuck them and stole one of the clerk's cars and took all three of them out to the country to what they called a pea patch. On the way out there, apparently Nikki Ansley recognized Adams from going to school with him, and he takes his ski mask off. And then to get them out in the country, and at that point, Adams orders one clerk, the clerk Candace, a driver, and Kenneth Vandiver get in the trunk of the car, and he takes Nikki Ansley out to the woods and rapes her. Then he comes back, and they get all of them, all three people out, put them on the ground. Then they walk away, and they come back and get Kenneth Vandiver, talk to him, then bring him back again. And at that point, he starts protesting, wanting his medicine. At that point, Aaron Cobb shoots him in the head, and he falls over. And then one by one, the two girls are both shot, shot in the head.
And the weapon is a shotgun.
From reading the opinion, they had a shotgun to do the robbery, but the weapon in this case was a shotgun, I think a pistol both. There's a shotgun I think was used in all the shootings. And so what happened, they wanted to make sure the girls were dead. They thought the girls were dead, picked them up by the hair of the head, looked at them, thought they were dead, and they decided to go leave them. And they left the field, left them to die in the field, and sure enough, two of the girls survived. And then they got up, got some help, and they shortly arrested both Cobb and Adams together at my friend's house. And once they found them, Cobb made a complete confession to everything. So it never was much of a question of guilt because, number one, they were identified by the victims, the surviving victims, and he made a complete confession about this. And that was pretty much the case.
Case was tried in Rusk?
Tried in Rusk, no change of venue.
And a lot of folks around Rusk would have known the kind of
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that was kind of the sad thing, because he would just kind of hang at the station, and he wasn't doing anything, hanging around the station. That's what really hurt.
Jack, are you going to tell us how you would defend this case?
Yeah, one of the things that they talked about, that defense did, was they talked about the duress, that Cobb, that Adams threatened Cobb. Cobb is the one who's on execution watch tonight. Adams threatened Cobb with hurting his family. And this was brought up in the defense. Even though at multiple points this was really the first time that they had talked about this kind of a duress defense, at no time did Cobb tell the police, oh, Adams is going to hurt my family and things like that. And, you know, it doesn't seem like the defense really developed that a whole lot.
Jack, do me a favor, explain what duress is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Duress is if you don't do what I tell you to do, then I'm going to hurt either you or somebody that you love. And so out of duress, you comply with what I tell you to do because you don't want to get hurt and you don't want your family members to get hurt.
You must admit it's got to be something of imminent danger to hurt them. It's got something to persuade any person of normal sensitivity to have committed the crime because
That's
you're
right.
so frightened to do it.
There has to be an immediacy to the threat of violence and bodily injury. And at the time, it doesn't. From what we know in the facts, it doesn't seem like this became much of an issue until at trial. One of their at this point, Adams Cobb really could have explained that he didn't explain anything, that during the confession that he gave to the police, he didn't want to say anything about Adams and how Adams had threatened him because he was afraid that Adams would turn around and from jail get other people to hurt his family. That might have made the defense of duress a lot more believable. Also, while he was in jail and things like that, he could have said, hey, I was afraid of Adams. That's why I didn't say anything. There is as to when he could have talked about this, because remember, the victims in this case had all talked about, they were in the presence of the victims. So the victims, if there had been any kind of threats, and this was actually brought up at the trial, that the victims didn't hear about any kind of threats by Adams to Cobb. Well, except that there was a moment when Cobb and Adams walked away and were not in earshot of anyone before they came back and shot Vandiver. This, frankly, Cobb could have said that this is exactly when Adams came and threatened him and his family.
Can you hold up just a second? We have Dave Atwood on the phone. Hello, Dave. Where are you?
I'm down at the corner of Main Street and Vins, right in front of the museums.
Okay. Over at our friends, the Methodist Church.
Right, right in front of St. Paul's United Methodist Church.
Okay, and how many vigilants have you there, Dave?
We have a good turnout today for us. We got 13 people here.
Mercy.
And it just worked out, I guess, with a lot of schedules. And so we have a good, very diverse group of people out here. And again, you know, I said before, this is a wonderful corner, because especially on a Thursday, a lot of people go into the museum in the evening, and they stop by, and they toot their horn, and we've got little literature things that we hand out to people, and so it's really a good vigil. It really is a good vigil protest.
We have not been able to be in touch with Huntsville, so I cannot report at this time whether or not the witnesses have crossed the road and the process is going on. Of course, we always hope not, but we will have to catch you up on that a little later. But
okay.
How do people get in touch with the Texas Coalition?
Okay, the best way would be to go to our website, which is tcadp.org.
The Texas Coalition Against Death Penalty, that forms an acronym, TCADP.
Right.
And you go www.tcadp.org.
Right, right.
Thank you, David.
Okay, Ray, thank you.
Bye-bye. And so that was Dave Atwood down at Methodist Church on Bins and Main. And that is just one of several anti-execution demonstrations going on around the state. It happens to be the one closest to us, so we frequently go to Houston. But we have gone down in the valley and to San Antonio and to Austin and other places in the past. Sorry to interrupt you, Jack. What is this duress defense used frequently, and does it ever work?
No, it doesn't. It's not used real frequently. It can work, but again, you have the challenge here is to convince the jury that you had no choice, that somebody effectively had a gun to your head and forced you to have to do something that you didn't want to do.
Let me
add something about that, if I might. What you've always got to do in a case, the reason duress is hard, you've got to admit committing the crime, like self-defense. You admit I did the shooting, that's a confession. But you got to admit that I'm excused from it because someone forced me to do it, and anybody in my shoes would have done the same thing. Now, to do that, number one, you have to establish a motive. Why would Adams, the co-defendant, want to force Cobb to do the killing? Real simple. The way it could be explained is quite simply. They have been committing robberies using ski masks. And guess who is identified at the last robbery? Adams. And who identifies him? Someone he'd gone to school with. Not only that, he pulls his mask off, and that means the other two witnesses can identify him.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Cobb has his mask on. So Adams knows that he knows perfectly well. At this point, you need to interrupt for something.
Yeah, I need to interrupt because Gloria, what's going on up there?
Well, the execution is going on. Richard Cobb is going to be murdered. He asked none of his family to be there, so there are no people witnessing for him. The victim's family Richard has three friends who are standing with us holding signs, and they said they saw the victim's families, and I believe the media said they were going to witness, so I'm assuming they're in there. But Texas's 496th execution is proceeding like clockwork in a state that is the expert on legal murder.
How many other vigilants have you there besides Richard's personal friends?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of us.
9 of you there, 13 at the vigil in Houston.
Oh, well.
And, being at the Methodist Church is not quite as stressful as being at the death house in Huntsville, but But I like to keep a track of the numbers. We've got this grim countdown going down. This is 96. Four more executions and we hit 500.
Exactly.
And, so the person that will actually be the 500 is currently appearing on the list. And let me tell the listeners out there, if you are listening to this in broadcast as opposed to via the web, you can go to executionwatch.org and the pending list is all there. And if you join our Facebook page, you will get all the information you need about efforts, not necessarily by us, but by everybody, gets reposted there, efforts to lobby the governor as if that was going to do any good and do other things trying to help the case.
And the man that is now scheduled to be the 500th is Elroy Chester, a man with limited intellectual ability.
We will have Elroy's attorney on later in this show.
Oh, okay, great.
Okay. Gloria, keep us informed.
Okay, and I want to, one of the women that is with us is from Nice, France.
Yes.
She visits Gilmar Guevara, who is on death row. And she said death row was packed today with visitors. I'm going to be going tomorrow, so I guess I better get up there early. And, Jamie, if you're listening, I'll see you tomorrow on tea also.
Thank you, Gloria. And that was Gloria Ruback, who is keeping the vigil at the Death House in Huntsville. Where were we, Jim?
Okay, let me go back. Because, see, in this case, at least you got an arguable case. Because here's what Adams can say. He could say in the prior robberies, nobody was injured. We didn't shoot anybody. We didn't kill anybody. In this particular case, the only motive to kill anybody was not me, because I wasn't identified. It was Adams. He was the one identified. He had a reason.
So Cobb could say that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so at least the jury would understand that. And so at that point, what you've got to do, and the next thing you've got to do, you've got to cover the fact when you claimed your arrest. And prosecutors love to do this. They want to get you where you're going one-on-one and contradicting the police.
Mm-hmm.
The first big problem you got is he did not tell the police when he was confessing that he was forced to do it by Cobb. You've got to explain that.
Sure.
And the explanation is real simple, is that Cobb told him if he talked, he would threaten, he would kill him, he'd kill his family, he would threaten
or
the whole family.
You mean Adams told Cobb?
Adams told Cobb.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, the reason he said, I didn't tell the police, look, I know how you police work. As soon as I tell you, you're going to run in and tell Adams what I said. And I can't afford to do that. And I was too frightened. I was frightened that if I told you, you'd run in and tell Adams what I'd said, and my family would be in danger. So that explains why he didn't tell the police. Now, the next problem he had is that none of the victims heard the threat. But if you go through the sequence of events, what occurred, if you recall when we talked about the facts, they took all three out of the car after the sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Then they took Vanderroff and had some conversation at that point out of the earshot of the two remaining surviving witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point is when the threat was made. It's when he said, I can't afford to have these people live because they can identify me. This is what Adams would be saying to Cobb, and you're going to do the killing. And why would he want Cobb to do the killing? Real simple. Because it's that strange thing that a lot of people think, if I make my fall partner do all the bad work, he'll never squeal on me because he'll be the real bad guy.
Uh-huh.
He's doing the shooting. Remember that case where we had the guys that escaped from prison, they shot that policeman a whole bunch of times, and all the defendants joined the shooting? He was already dead. Why? They won't incriminate those guys. They wouldn't be talking.
Okay.
So he has at least an arguable duress defense. He could show motive. He could explain why he didn't tell the police. He can also explain why the witnesses didn't hear him.
He tried it, and either because it wasn't well-formed, it didn't work.
We don't know. I didn't see the trial transcript. But all I'm saying is, as Larry once said, you know, you dance with who brung you, and that's the only defense they had. And they could have developed it. They had at least a developed jurist defense.
Were these guys tried in the same or separate trials?
No, what had happened, Adams had already been tried earlier and already been given the death penalty. He's been already, no, they were tried separately. He was tried first, and he was executed about a year ago.
Yeah.
But that's the only defense you've got.
Is there a jailhouse snitch in this?
Yeah, Larry, I think,
Who's going to handle this?
Well, first off, he testified at two different spots. Why don't you talk about the guilt or innocence part where he testified to guilt innocence, Larry? He testified at He testified at the guilt innocence phase plus punishment, right?
Right. He testified at both. I mean, the guilt innocence phase would have been where he tried to make the duress defense, right, which was not successful. And then also testified at punishment. And is his, the co-defendant Adams actually was executed 1 year ago tomorrow.
Okay.
Right. And these are two young men, 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
Cobb had never been to prison before, but
he'd been to juvenile, but not prison.
Oh, he'd been to juvenile. He'd committed some acts before.
Yeah.
And so if we had punishment, he's been found guilty. The duress defense did not work, despite his going forward and admitting to having participated in the matter under duress from Adams. We get to punishment, and at punishment, even, the issues are, future dangerousness and the defense issue of mitigation. What the state does at punishment, they throw everything at you.
Mm-hmm.
They can throw prior crimes and bad acts. And bad acts could even be, as Jim has discussed before, a finding of not guilty,
yeah,
in a criminal case, including reputation evidence. So they threw it all at him. So as Jim mentioned before, Adams and Cobb were on a robbery spree. They had committed two prior robberies before this robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And they, again, hadn't killed anybody in those two prior robberies, but this one they did. So that was admitted, the fact that Cobb was involved in two prior robberies. They threw that at him. Also, law enforcement right there in Rusk, the police chief and an assistant chief talked about his reputation for being a peaceful person, of the bad reputation.
Yeah.
They would clearly testify as to their opinion about his reputation based on their knowledge of his prior bad acts. They also let one of the young ladies who had been shot and severely injured, she testified about the seriousness of her physical injuries and her emotional injuries. Again, pulling on the heartstrings of the jury, which is what the DAs would do. Also talked about when he was in boot camp, the fact that he was a bad actor in boot camp and had assaulted one of the supervisors in boot camp. And a person from the boot camp came forward and testified that, you know, Cobb is just not afraid of authority. So he is of definite future danger. And they even called back, they called back a, Thompson, the snitch, who went into, well, he told me he was going to do all these things, and he expressed no remorse, showing future danger, that he was doing crimes while right there in Rusk, trading for cocaine and so forth. He was continuing to commit various different crimes and bad acts.
And Larry, we've got a caller, Susan Orlansky, coming in from Alaska. And what I think we're going to do with this during the next section of the show, I would like for us to have a discussion of how you defend yourself or how the defense lawyer tries to defend his client against this onslaught. I mean, this is a pretty heavy kind of thing. But right now I've got Susan. Susan!
Good afternoon.
Susan, I understand that you're in Anchorage, Alaska.
I am.
Okay, not that you can see Russia from there, but up there, what kind of law do you usually practice?
I am currently primarily a civil litigator. I have a background with the State Public Defender Agency, and I am currently a partner in a small firm that is a litigation firm. We do a little of a lot of things, including some criminal, but I would say it's primarily complex civil litigation.
How in the world did you get into doing pro bono work for Texas death row inmates in the appellate part of their lives?
Approximately 11 years ago, I read an article in Champion, which is the magazine of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and it made the point that not all inmates on death row in states around the country are entitled to appointed counsel at the post-conviction relief stage. And that stunned me. I'd never thought about that. I'm certainly well aware of Gideon, and I'm aware that in local practice, our inmates, the criminal defendants, have a right to appointed counsel for post-conviction relief application. And the editorial continued that lawyers who live in non-death penalty states, and Alaska is a non-death penalty state, have an obligation to step up and help in states that have death penalties where there is no system for appointing counsel because the good-hearted people in those states are completely overwhelmed. And I was just, I'd never thought of it. I was gratified that I lived in a non-death penalty state, but I never thought of kind of putting my time and money on the line and actually doing the work. So it gave us contact information with Robin Mayer at the American Bar Association's Capital Representation Project, and my partner and I called Robin and said, we'd like to help. And I think Robin nearly dropped the phone. She runs around the country trying to recruit people and doesn't sure. normally get volunteers. And when she found out who we were and where we were, she was particularly stunned because normally people in the lower 48 and 100 lawyer firms say they don't have the resources to do it. And we were at that point four people out here in the frozen north. But Robin essentially match-made for us. She had us look at slim files of a couple of inmates, and we settled on the case that we did. We jumped into the case almost precisely 10 years ago. It'll be 10 years in early June, I think, and we've been with it ever since.
And that's on Chester's case?
Yes, that's Elroy Chester's case. We took Mr. Chester's case compared to a couple of others that she offered to us, partly because it was closer. She first had us started looking in Alabama, and we said, wait a minute, maybe we could get something that's only two plane rides away.
Instead of three or four.
So that got us into Texas, and Elroy Chester's case had already been through the first appeal and post-conviction relief stages, and all that was open to him was his Atkins claim. And we naively believed that that would be simpler and more straightforward, particularly for lawyers from far away, than having to litigate sort of actual innocence or ineffective assistance of counsel, all of which would benefit enormously by being on the ground, knowing the cast of characters, having local investigation. So we took this sort of relatively straightforward one-issue post-conviction relief case without fully comprehending it would be a decade-long battle.
And it has been a decade-long battle.
It has.
And it turned out to be more complicated than you anticipated.
Yeah. We didn't realize how much on the cutting edge of some of the issues we would be. There's clearly a batch of cases around the country, Texas as well as others, that came into court immediately after Atkins. We didn't realize we were kind of at the front of the wave, although our case has moved slowly enough that many cases have caught up and passed us since. And we certainly didn't anticipate Briseño coming down in the early stages of our case. We looked at it, and we naively believed that Mr. Chester had been diagnosed mentally retarded by a psychologist who testified at his punishment phase trial, and we sort of thought, well, we get another psychologist to say that, this should be fairly straightforward.
And that didn't prove to be the case so far.
Not at all.
You know, Elroy is got a date set.
Yes.
And stands a very high likelihood, not an absolute likelihood, but a high likelihood of being the 500th execution in Texas since the Furman case.
I'm aware of that. We've never wanted to land on that kind of a round number and draw extra attention to the case. I'm sort of hoping that the numbers change. I mean, I'm hoping that some miracle happens and my client doesn't get executed at all. I would love it if we weren't the 500th, just because I'm not looking for that kind of attention.
Well, that does mean that there's going to be an awful lot of attention to that case because of just the nature of the numerology of it.
I'm aware of that, yeah.
Now that you've been at this for a decade, was it a good decision for you to even start?
I have learned an enormous amount about law, about people, and about myself. I mean, it's been very challenging. I've never before been responsible for somebody's life in this way as a lawyer. It always brings me back to sort of parenting when I felt like I was responsible for my children's lives. So it's been a very profound experience and not an easy one, but I think I really do go through life believing that we're put on this earth for some reason to do some good or to try to do some good, and I feel like this was the right thing to do. I've never had any second thoughts about being willing to give it a try. I'm obviously distraught over the unhappy outcome, but I'm not happy that we invested our time and our resources in trying.
You know, of course, Ms. Orlansky, that the broadcasts from this radio station are being heard on Texas Death Row, and maybe your client is listening.
I didn't realize that, but I have no idea what he can listen to. I think we bought him a radio once upon a time, so maybe he is. He does not know I agreed to do the interview.
If he is listening, you're doing him proud by just being as human as you are and as anguished as you are about the issues before you. And I want to thank you for being a guest on Execution Watch and wish you the very best of luck, especially in the pending case.
All right. I do appreciate that.
Thank you very much. And my regards to your partner, because your partner is plural, because that level of pro bono effort from a small firm is rare.
Yeah. No, it has definitely been a team effort from here. I've personally done the bulk of it, but I clearly could not have done it without the support of all of my partners.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
And good night. Okay. And, that was a trip.
Well, you notice that all civil large litigators,
Gloria,
Ray,
wait a minute,
I noticed that.
Gloria's calling in. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I am here, Ray, and the execution is over. There's actually quite a flurry of media going on, I guess, because not too many people from that county are executed. I know the reporter for the Jacksonville Progress has called me at least a dozen times to make sure he could talk to me.
Okay.
But and not only are the local TV stations from the county, but are from Tyler.
Yeah.
But the BBC is here again. They're working on an hour-long documentary, so they've been out here for several executions. Anthony Haynes and I can't remember.
Yeah, well, we just got there talking to Susan, and her situation about a very small firm in Alaska that's doing yeoman's work trying to save Elroy Chester.
Oh, his attorney is from Alaska.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so are they using the issue of his mental disability?
They're using everything. And she was very human, very concerned, and somewhat taken aback when I said it was possible that Elroy was listening to her words on this radio station on a radio that the firm had bought and given him.
Are the men on death watch actually allowed to have their radios, or do they take them? I don't think
Chester's on death watch at the present.
Yeah, everybody that's got a date on death watch.
Oh, everybody's on death. Well, he may not have access to a radio.
So I'm not sure. I'll ask somebody.
Check on that and give us a report back.
Yeah, I will. Okay.
Thank you, Gloria.
All right, well, another bad day in Huntsville.
Four more to go, and then we hit Chester. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Mercy, it's a full show. We've got a lot of things going. Ms. Orlansky sounded like an attorney who took this seriously in a very pragmatic way.
Civil lawyers learn pretty fast. I said earlier I was fascinated. Civil lawyers and every lawyers are litigators. We're criminal lawyers. They learn to be a criminal lawyer real quick. Trust me.
Okay, I'm interested on how do you deal with these jailhouse snitch lawyers? I posted something on our Facebook page today about a Dallas case. There were no witnesses to the case, and then the big reward showed up, and there were a bunch of witnesses to the case trying to get for the reward, and then there was the usual Dallas County throwdown snitch. We had this in the Randall Dale Adams case, who was the jailhouse snitch in several murder cases.
Job training program in the Dallas jail.
It's a job training program in Dallas jail. And now the case got found actually, he was found actually innocent by a Dallas court. It goes to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and we close at 5, Chief Justice, and the court said, no, no, we're going to reinstate this case. And the DA says, well, if you come up with some new evidence, and the issue is not new evidence. The issue is the old evidence was bad. How do you deal with jailhouse snitches?
In this case, the jailhouse snitch, Thompson, testified just like the prosecutor wanted him to. In terms of future dangerousness, said that Cobb told me that if I were put in the same situation again, I'd do the exact same thing. And Cobb's lawyer didn't cross-examine him at all, but just depended on arguing the general, he's got a motive to lie. It would be helpful to go actually against him, going through his record and so forth, and just letting it be known that you're doing this for, you're getting something for this. That is that this prosecutor has promised you some leniency. And in this case, there were two letters, one of which was provided right before the argument, where the prosecutor had written to Thompson's parole officer, letting him know that they were not going to proceed on a felon in possession case charge against him to help him get out on parole, or help his parole not to be revoked. So there was a quid pro quo. He was lying for a reason.
You could demonstrate a quid pro quo.
And very, very, very much demonstrable. He was lying for a reason. And his lawyer, for whatever reason, decided not to reopen and also not to cross-examine Thompson. But when they get up and lie like that, about the only cross-examination, the only refutation was Cobb himself standing up and saying, "You're lying." It's almost a natural reaction. People saying terrible things about you, you need to get up and get them straight.
That doesn't make judges happy. But Susan,
right.
What's cooking?
The obvious answer to your question is...
Wait a minute. Let me get Susan a little more volume.
Okay. The answer to your question is, what do you do about it? Well, if you do nothing else, I guess you get your client to jump up and say, scream, you lying SOB. And if you do nothing else, which is what happened in this case, because Cobb, what happened is when the other inmate or the jailhouse snitch was testifying, he testified that Cobb spoke to him in prison, that Cobb said he was mad that the girls lived, that he was in jail because the girls were still alive. And he showed no remorse, but he also, the other inmate or the jailhouse snitch, when he said that Cobb said he almost got a rush when he shot Vanderbilt, the other man, that's when Cobb jumped up and said, "You lying SOB."
Right there in court.
Right there in court. And so, of course, the judge naturally told him to sit down and be quiet. But
and order
really,
in the court and the
right,
usual
right.
gavel banging and,
right.
and all of that.
And but it's more or less that, you know, clearly Cobb has nothing to lose by doing that. And it would come across, it probably was a spontaneous reaction. I mean, it might have been instigated by his lawyer, but it might have been a spontaneous reaction on Cobb's part, too. I mean, we don't know.
Well, when you're in jail, you don't get to pick the character of the people you're in jail with. You could be in jail with some liars, couldn't you, Jim?
Every once in a while that happens.
I will point this out. Apparently, the other inmate did testify to some facts that what the state said basically was unless Cobb told him, he wouldn't have any other way of knowing. Now, obviously, the state could tell him, but, you know, that's something we don't know. And what it was is where they took the girls and the other man, and that the girls were on their knees praying. There were certain things. Either it came from – it had to either come from Cobb or it had to come from the state or somebody on law enforcement. Otherwise, Cobb wouldn't know.
And Cobb's dead now, so that doesn't mean that we're going to get a second opinion on this.
Now, other evidence, there was other evidence at punishment. State brought out evidence that obviously the victims of this crime testified, but there were other robberies in Jacksonville. And the state also had the testimony of other victims of the other robberies in Jacksonville. Those robberies weren't adjudicated, but apparently Cobb admitted to those robberies. And the other inmate said that Cobb also told him about those robberies. Cobb had a bad juvenile record. He was in boot camp. He apparently assaulted a corrections officer in juvenile. And he was, when he was arrested, I guess he was violent with the police. Defense put on his adoptive mother. This was, I guess, this is where they were trying to put on mitigating evidence. There was an adopted mother who adopted three boys. Cobb and his two brothers, their biological mother apparently was a drug user and abused alcohol. She couldn't take care of the three boys, so the three boys were put in foster care, and then the adoptive mother adopted all three boys. Apparently, all three boys had serious problems, behavior problems, and so forth. The adopted mother said that she tried to get them counseling and treatment, but still, there were problems. Defense put on an expert, basically an expert, to bring out that he may have had brain damage from his mother's use of alcohol and drugs. So how much this was mitigating, it's hard to say, because in some sense it can be mitigating, but it can also cut the other way.
Yeah.
And because now there was state put on a psychiatrist who said he was a sociopath. So this evidence that his mother was a alcohol drug user, that he basically had problems since he was, you know, very young, you could kind of interpret it.
Okay, we've got two kids, co-defendants in a series of robberies, apparently a crime spree over a short period of time. And the last of the crimes, there was homicide. Were any crimes after the one that involved the homicide?
No.
Okay.
Well, by the way, Ray, we've never really answered your question how to cross-examine a snitch. And Jack Lee have talked about that earlier. Jack and I had a long discussion how you handle a snitch. Because the real two things you need to learn to do, because it always happens in capital murder cases, is how to cross-examine a victim of a crime and how to cross-examine a snitch. And
well, that's all the evidence in this case is a victim.
Exactly. And you've got to learn how to handle that. And Jack and I had a big discussion on how to do that.
Well, Jack, you and Jim jump into it.
Well, the whole point of cross-examining the whole point of a jailhouse snitch really lies in his credibility. He obviously has a reason to lie. He's got, if he tells the state what they want to hear, the state's going to go easy on his case, as is the case with Thompson here. Now, one of the things that you really want to develop why the snitch is lying, and you want to throw things at him that tell the jury or the fact finder that he is lying. One of the questions that you could ask in this situation would be, who was the first person that you talked to after you came back, after you found all this information that Cobb confessed to you and said all these ugly things to you? Who was the first person you talked to? And do they have any kind of notes or anything like that? Did they decide, hey, you know what, we believe you, and rather than just taking your word for it, we're going to put a wire on you, and you go back into the jail population, so that not only do we have your word, but we've got Cobb confessing in his own voice. They never did any of that. Mm-hmm. This is something that they could have asked Thompson to do, but they didn't. The other thing that they could ask, and this is done in federal court all the time, once you told them of all these ugly things that Cobb told you he did, did they polygraph you? Did they polygraph you? Because that's one of the things that the federal government, that the feds do. They want to know if you're a jailhouse snitch, are you actually telling the truth or not? And in this case, We don't know. And again, these are the, all of these things with the power of the state behind behind the prosecution. They have all the equipment they could possibly use in order to do all of these things, in order to wire Thompson, in order to get him to do a polygraph. Did they do any of that? No, it doesn't look like they did. As for punishment in this case, they actually the state brought in the victims
again,
and they brought the victims in to talk about what happened. And frankly, the only sense in that is to horrify
emotionalize.
Yes, it's to emotionalize and to horrify the jury in order to push them into being angry. One of the things that you could do to mitigate that is apologize to the victims for bringing them here for their testimony, because every time the victims have to testify, they relive over and over again the horrors of what happened to them. And rather than having them talk about what happened to them, talk about why they're there. Talk about that the prosecution wants to bring this out. Put the prosecution on trial here.
Mm-hmm.
Put the prosecution on trial for not giving Thompson the credibility that he needs, and put the prosecution on trial for not giving for making the victims relive the experience.
Because basically they've already said the same thing to the jury before.
Anytime you have a situation where you've entered a plea of guilt or admitted it, and then the state calls the victim, what you always do is say, Ray, you realize that this is a horrible experience for you, and I'm sorry you went through that. And do you understand there was no reason for you to have to do that? Because we've already confessed to doing that. There's no reason for you to relive this experience again, because we confessed to it. And the only reason it did is that prosecutor over there is making you relive it again so he can get a notch in his gun to get another guilty verdict. And get a notch in his gun to get another, making you relive that.
So you blame the prosecutor.
Exactly, because see, in this particular case, Cobb confessed to the murder. Mm-hmm. Snitch told about it. There was no reason to call these two women, the two people of the robberies, victims. No reason whatsoever, other than to get, Jack said, get the jury angry. What you want to do is point out to the jury and apologize to them and say it's the state fault. You're having to relive this horrible experience again, and there's no reason for it. We're sorry you had to do it. The reason we confessed. We didn't want you to go through this again. And then if they recall the victim, which they did again, the victim of the shooting and the punishment, do the same thing again.
What? Of course, none of us were actually there.
I understand.
What is the effect of the jury of the mentally handicapped guy being the actual murder victim in this case?
That is just what's really, there's no way to have that. It's horrible. There's no way you can handle that. And one thing I want to add when we're talking about this same thing, you always, when you do cases like this, you want to remember, there's two cardinal rules of trying a case, knowing why you're there and knowing who your audience is. Your audience is the jury. So you always want to demonstrate things to a jury. What do you always
do? And you've had a role in eliminating people from the jury that you think are hazardous.
I am. So what you always want to do at the very conclusion, after you get through cross-examining a snitch, what you want to do always, and you look at that snitch and say, looky, we've only got your word that this happened, isn't that correct? And you give me one good reason why this jury, then you list all the crimes he had done, all the things he'd done.
You look up his record.
That's right. You give me one reason why a man who'd been in boot camp and did all these things, his evil thing, did everything in his background, and you didn't take a polygraph, didn't try to tape record this guy, can you tell that jury why they should believe you? It's not to say you're pitting him against the jury. You always conclude with that.
Okay.
That's the only way you can.
And you can get away with that without the judge.
Absolutely.
Just coming unglued at you.
Looky, the judge is not your audience. The judge is the jury. And I don't.
Do you really care what the judge thinks?
Most lawyers do. A good trial lawyer doesn't give a damn what the judge thinks, and that's not his audience. Because in this case, it's all the jury. And you get yelled at, so what? In fact, when Susan mentioned the stuff about the guy getting up and yelling, I tried a case with a series of lawyers from Miami, and in every case where there's a snitch that testifies,
yep.
they make their client get up and holler during the middle of the
That's part of the training.
You're lying SOB. They did him to do it. Because think about it for a moment. If somebody is lying to put you in jail, it's going to make you angry, and you're going to react to it. And the jury can relate to that.
Well, you know, these two fellers, Bianca Adams, been dead about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And now today, Richard Cobb has been executed by the state of Texas. East Texas, dumb, probably drunk or stoned.
That's your part of the country, isn't it, right? East Texas?
Yeah. I've got all my relatives from up there. None of them made death row. I managed to make it to prison for a while, but decided that I had better things to do with my life than hang around in prison. By the way, I want to thank all the folks in Texas prisons who go out of their way to listen to this show now that we're back on broadcast, and I want to tell all the guys on death row, we invite you, if you wish to be the interview on the show they're doing about you, I will come to death row. We will audio and videotape that, and it will be played on this show because you may be your own best defense. Now, we got to cut this with your lawyer and other things. Yes, Susan?
I think there's one important point we should make here. It is always a bad idea to be talking about your case with other inmates. No good will ever come of that, right?
Well, I mean that's
no reason to talk about your case with other inmates.
I wouldn't even let Martha Stewart talk about her case while she was after the conviction.
No good can come of it. Only bad can come of that. And there's no reason to do it. There's no reason to tell other inmates your communications with your lawyer, your plans of the case. None of that should be discussed with any other inmates. You have no benefit.
Do you not tell your client some things about your strategy because of that hazard?
Well, people, you know, as you know, Ray, people just like to talk. People like to chat, and people don't differ. I mean, they don't realize that if you're in prison and you're an inmate, do not talk about your case. I mean, they're not your friends, they're not your girlfriends, they're fellow inmates, don't discuss it.
I reserved a few minutes for myself in this program because, number one, I'm very glad to be on broadcast here on radio station KPFT, and I'm a very strong believer in the concept and principles of Pacifica Foundation and KPFT, and we're the people that make media work because we have ordinary people like me can wander in here as an ex-convict and start doing a show within a week after I get out of Texas prison and ultimately become general manager of the radio station and do 30 years of the prison show and now do Execution Watch, a program which I absolutely despise. And we always hope for a stay so that we don't have to do this, and someday, hopefully sooner than later, we will stop killing people and there will be no need of the show. I want to thank all of the staff for making it. I'm Jim Skelton and Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas and Jack Lee were on tonight. Michael Gillespie's over in the wing. He'll be with us on future shows. They go through a lot of work, study what happened in the case, study the media at the time, study the current media, study the jail transcript when they can get it, and they study all the appeals, both the briefs and the opinions. I want to thank Gloria Ruback with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And you can get in touch with Gloria and her work. She was a reporter from Huntsville tonight. It's abolitionmovement.org. And you got to be real exact, www.abolitionmovement.org, because the word abolition brings up a lot of things on search engines. Dave Atwood of tcadp.org. Dave was the vigil here in Houston. Susan Orlansky, that was an interesting interview for me, and it's amazing that a small law firm in Anchorage, Alaska, has taken on the burden, and they pay all the expenses to come down here and visit their client and work on the case and do all of that. That's amazing and enviable work, and they are much appreciated. By the way, if you want to check out their website, it's frozenlaw.com. Frozenlaw.com.
Since Sarah Palin's a governor, it may be worth the trip to get out of the state. Yeah, which was the governor. That may be the reason they did it.
And they don't have a lot to worry, death penalty cases to worry about up there. We do this show every time there is an execution watch. We are not so much advocates here as we are reporters. The lawyers work very hard to just the facts. Joe Friday kind of stuff. It's my job to ask the questions where I think that maybe the facts could have been recorded differently at different times. And if you want to look into the record of this state of Texas for exonerations, even that happens. Our producer, the one that does all of the legwork to make this happen, is Elizabeth. And Elizabeth can be reached at her email address, eliza.tex.usa@gmail.com. The technical director in the studio and the chief wizard of the website, it is Otis McClay. And Otis McClay is legend in these parts. He
a legion of personalities.
Yeah, he has absolutely been here and stood by me. The theme music comes from Victoria Panetti, She Monster International. And I can see Wally in the next room, and stay tuned for Progressive Forum on radio station KPFT Houston.